tarry here, where the stories never grow old, and you hear something new every time they are told and it comes clear. So tarry here, where it doesn't matter your age, and when we gather round the table, we all take the stage year after year. So tarry here, we're living now and we're all in this place.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenradio.org. We are broadcasting again this week from Bolivar, West Virginia. I'm Fanny Crawford.
And Stassi Olkowski.
And we are your co-hosts for the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour. And our theme today, surprise theme, oh, maybe we mentioned it last week, I can't remember, is Stephen Hawking. Today is Stephen Hawking Day, and we are honoring the passing and the work of that great scientist. But before we get into that, Stosh, did you want to do a little weekend review? Is that what you had in mind?
Well, I learned this week that Elizabeth Ellis is going to be, they're working on bringing back Elizabeth Ellis for the Speak Story series, which was canceled due to the snowstorm.
So when you say back, you don't mean back to life, you mean back to Shepherdstown, West
Back
Virginia.
To Shepherdstown, yes. We okay. haven't perfected that second part okay. of that act yet. So they're shooting for December, if possible. Depends on her schedule. And so that's good news.
Yeah, that
and,
is great to know. Very
that'll
good.
That'll be really good to have her back. And she's very interested in coming back, which is nice. And this past week, all I did was work on stories and gizmos and stuff like that.
Yeah, you have a lot of science work, science story work coming up,
yes,
don't you?
Yes, I do. I'm going to be going back to the elementary school. I haven't gotten a fixed date yet. And I'm also going to be telling stories April 19th at the Sharpsburg Library. And I believe I'm going to have a good audience there, because at our book club this past week, a number of people were very interested. So,
very good.
And also, I'm going to tell a story in Utah this week to my grandchildren.
All right. Well, that's a given. If yes. you're going to be around your grandchildren, yep. I'm sure you are going to be telling lots of stories.
And we're even taking a gadget with us.
Of course, yes. Always a gadget.
Yes.
It's science, after all.
Right. Well, this won't be science. This
oh,
is
no.
I'm going to do the ugly duckling.
With a gadget?
Yes. I can't ever do that on the radio because it's visual, but I have a device that I... Do you want to hear this?
Yeah.
I have a device that I made. I found a rather strange-looking duck in a Goodwill that was made out of pieces, out of real thin pieces of wood, and it could qualify as an ugly duckling. It's brown, kind of tawdry-looking, and then I got a wooden cutout of a swan and painted it. And what I did was I got a piece of cloth and two pieces of cloth sewn together. One side of the cloth is brown and one side is blue. And so I set this up so that the swan is underneath the cloth. And there's a magnet attached to it. And the duckling sits on top of the cloth with a metal base.
Wow.
And so I usually do this with my accordion because I play along with the song, The Ugly Duckling. And I do it with only my fingers on the left-hand side of the accordion and hold the device, hold the swan underneath. And so it's covered. The audience can't see it. And there's just this ugly duckling sitting on a kind of brown ugly kind of pond. And I do the story, and then at the end where the other swans tell them to look into the water and see, and I flip the whole thing over, and there's a beautiful blue and this nice, beautiful white long-necked swan. And it works really well, even with adults.
This is like those rag dolls from the old days where you flip the skirt over the doll and you get a different doll underneath. Interesting.
So my darling wife suggested that we take it with us to Utah so that I can show Matthew and Grace.
How big is it? Fits in your suitcase.
It'll fit in a suitcase. Terry's a wonderful packer.
Okay. So it's about the size of a bread box, maybe a little smaller than a bread box.
About a small, medium-sized toolbox.
Okay.
And it's kind of flat. So. And it can be taken apart.
Okay. So. Well, I spent part of the week getting ready for a workshop I'm going to do with Eileen Evans at the end of the month. And I'll be working on my T.H. Barnes stories. And she's coaching me on staying in T.H.'s voice for 90 minutes so I can do an entire performance. And that, of course, has been my goal all along. But it is hard to stay in character for a long, long time, depending on how much sleep I've had the night before.
Do you mind if I ask you about that?
What?
I have a question about that.
About how much sleep I get?
About, no, staying.
None of your beeswax. Andy Makepeace Ladd III.
Okay. No, about staying in character. When you do, I've heard you do TH a number of times, different parts of the story, and I think you do it very well. When you're doing it, do you think you're TH? Or do you... In your mind, are you Fanny pretending to be TH?
I'm not pretending. I'm honoring.
Okay. You...
So I'm trying to process him, present him. I'm channeling is a possible word, but that's not a word that he would have used. So it's not a word that I'm really comfortable with. But it's about being true to him. And so I have to be on guard that Fanny doesn't come through. I can even use the same audio. You know, I can sound like him, but if I'm not saying what he would say, then that's not a good thing.
Well, I just have a suggestion from my...
Yes.
Saying this, is you should practice being him.
Yeah.
Thinking that you're him as much as possible. And it's not easy to do, but with practice, it really helps. When I've done characters on stage and things, I do the best I can so that if someone would call my name and would say, "Stash, I need your help," or something, I would not respond because I would not be there.
Mm-hmm.
And it really does help.
Yeah.
If you start thinking, and you know. And even to the point of rehearsing by yourself, being him without his words.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, I know that many people who perform in theater professionally do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, so far I have sat in his presence and talked to him and with him and spent a lot of time listening, I guess, proposing a question and then listening to the answer. And I do practice being his physical self, you know, walking and sitting and getting up and getting down and the physical gestures that go with his story, practicing those as him because they're not the same as my gestures would be.
I've seen you do some of that, and I think you do a great job already.
Well, it's a wonderful process, and Eileen has a theater background as well, a performance background. So she's really good at getting me to think about what I'm doing and defend why I'm doing something and think a little bit more deeply. And then, of course, I'm also working on music with her, with singing, which is probably a greater challenge for me than the physical stuff. But I am enjoying the process.
And I know you do. I know that both of us love being involved in it and doing the work. So
yeah. Okay, so
here we are.
I just wanted to say one more thing about what I did this past week, and that was I do have a performance coming up on April 21st of African American history, and so I've been working on that as well. But I'll do a little station break, and then we'll get into Stephen Hawking. Does that sound good? Okay. You're listening to the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenradio.org, and I'm Fanny Crawford.
And I'm Stosh Zielkowski.
And we are working on a theme today of Stephen Hawking. This is Stephen Hawking Day at Enlightened Radio, and we're going to tell some stories. I thought we could get into the spirit by using one of Lucy and Stephen Hawking's children's books.
That sounds great.
Lucy, of course, is Stephen Hawking's daughter, and we are honoring the passing of Stephen Hawking back in mid-March, March 14th, I think. And it's taken us a while to get this together. Mostly taken me a while to get this together. Stosh, you were ready to talk about Stephen Hawking on March 14th.
Well, and some would say I'm ready to talk
all
anyway.
Yeah, I would say that, right. And I definitely value that. But it has taken me some time to get up to speed. And so I've read bits and pieces, or sometimes the full text of, I think, five different Stephen Hawking's books. And I love the children's books. I didn't really know about these before we got involved in talking about A Brief History of Time and his other books. But these children's books are, of course, much easier to read.
Yes,
So this is the first book that he did in collaboration with his daughter, Lucy Hawking, George's Secret Key to the Universe. And I'm going to use chapter 4, not quite at the beginning, but where he's really, where George, the child, is getting to know his next door neighbors, who he has not met before. So,
and
yes,
I'm wondering, are you going to set this up?
Well,
or isn't this where George is looking for his pig?
Yes. Well, that happens before this.
Right.
So he's found the pig. Right. By this time, but well, go ahead. I'm interested to hear your setup,
George,
Stosh. What would you say to set this up?
George, a young boy, was his pig has gotten out and has gone into the next door neighbor's untended yard. It's not very neat. It's overgrown, and the pig has actually gone into the neighbor's house. And George didn't even know that there were neighbors there. The house has been kind of abandoned for a long time. And when he goes inside, he winds up meeting the people who live there.
Eric, who just moved in.
Yes.
Recently, yes.
Eric and Annie. And then there is a third personality that he meets, as you will hear, as Fanny reads this description from the book.
Okay. Thank you. So Eric, Annie's father, started fiddling around with a computer that George hadn't noticed before. He'd been too fascinated by the other objects in the room to look at the flat silver screen with its keyboard attached. And it was strange that George hadn't spotted the computer right away. He really wished he could persuade his mom and dad to buy him one. He was saving up his allowance for a computer, but at the current rate, he calculated it was going to take him at least 8 years to afford even a really junky second-hand computer. So instead, he had to use the clunky, slow old machines at school, which crashed every 5 minutes and had sticky fingerprints all over the screens. But Eric's computer was small and glossy. It looked powerful and neat, the sort of computer you might even find on a spaceship. Eric hit a couple buttons on the keyboard, and the computer made a sort of humming noise while bright flashes of color shot across the screen. He patted the computer happily. "You have forgotten something," said a strange mechanical voice. George jumped out of his skin. "Have I?" Eric looked confused for a moment. "Yes," said the voice. "You have not introduced me." "I'm so sorry," exclaimed Eric. "George, this is Cosmos, my computer." George gulped. He had no idea what to say. "You have to say hello to Cosmos," said Eric, in a side whisper to George. "Otherwise, he'll get offended." "Hello, Cosmos," said George nervously. He'd never spoken to a computer before, and he didn't quite know where to look.
"Hello, George," replied Cosmos. "Eric, you have forgotten something else."
"What now?" said Eric.
"You have not told George I am the most powerful computer in the world."
Eric rolled his eyes. "George, Cosmos is the most powerful computer in the world."
"That is correct. I am. In the future, there will be computers more powerful than me, but there are none in the past or present."
"Sorry about this," Eric whispered to George. "Computers can be a bit touchy."
"I am smarter than Eric, too," boasted Cosmos.
"Says who?" said Eric crossly, glaring at the screen.
"Says me," said Cosmos. "I can compute billions of numbers in a nanosecond in less time than it takes you to say Cosmos is great. I can compute the life of planets, of comets, of stars, and of galaxies before you can say Cosmos is the most impressive computer that I have ever seen. He is truly incredible. I can."
All right, said Eric. "Cosmos, you are the most impressive computer we have ever seen. Now, can we move on? I want to show George how a star is born."
"No,"
said Cosmos. "No," said Eric. "What do you mean, no, you ridiculous machine?"
"I don't want to. And I am not ridiculous. I am the most powerful computer that has ever been."
"Oh, please," pleaded George. "Please, Cosmos, I really want to see how a star is born. Please, won't you show me?" Cosmos was silent. "Oh, come on, Cosmos," said Eric. "Let's show George some of the wonders of the universe."
"Maybe,"
replied Cosmos sulkily. "George doesn't have a very high opinion of science," Eric said. "So this is our chance, Cosmos, to show him the other side of science."
"He must take the oath," said Cosmos.
"Good point. Smart, Cosmos," said Eric, leaping over to the blackboard. George turned and studied the writing on it more closely. It looked like a poem. "George," said Eric, "do you want to learn about the greatest subject in the whole universe?"
"Oh, yes," exclaimed George.
"Are you prepared to take a special oath to do so, to promise that you will use your knowledge only for good and not for evil?" Eric was staring at George intently from behind his big glasses. His voice had changed. He now sounded extremely serious. "This is very important, George. Science can be a force for good, but as you pointed out to me earlier, it can also do great harm. George stood up straighter and looked Eric in the eye. I am, he confirmed. Then, said Eric, look at the words on the blackboard. It is the oath of the scientist. If you agree with it, then read the oath out loud. George read what was written on the blackboard and thought about it for a moment. The words of the oath didn't frighten him. Instead, they made him feel tingly with excitement, right down to his toes. He read the oath out loud. I swear to use my scientific knowledge for the good of humanity. I promise never to harm any person in my search for enlightenment. The living room door opened, and his new friend Annie sidled in, clutching a huge bag of potato chips. Keep going, said Eric. You're doing very well. George read, I shall be courageous and careful in my quest for greater knowledge about the mysteries that surround us. I shall not use scientific knowledge for my own personal gain or give it to those who seek to destroy the wonderful planet on which we live. If I break this oath, may the beauty and wonder of the universe forever remain hidden from me. Eric clapped. Annie burst an empty potato chip bag. Cosmos flashed a rainbow of bright colors across his screen. Well done, George, said Eric. You are now the second youngest member of the Order of Scientific Inquiry for the Good of Humanity. He smiled at young Annie as he said that. I salute you, said Cosmos. From now on, I will recognize your command. And I'll let you have some chips, piped up Annie. Annie, we're just getting to the good part, said Eric. George, you may now use the secret key that unlocks the universe. Can I? Asked George. Where is it? Go over to Cosmos, said Eric quietly, and look at the keyboard. Can you guess which one you need to press? Can you figure out which one is the secret key that will unlock the universe for you? Annie, say nothing. George did as he was told. Cosmos might be the world's most powerful computer, but his keyboard was just an ordinary, familiar one with the letters and symbols laid out in the same order as even the school's crummiest, oldest computer. George thought hard. Which key would be the one to unlock the universe for him? He looked again at the keyboard, and he knew. It's this one, isn't it? He said to Eric, his finger hovering. Eric nodded. That's it, George. Press it to begin. George's finger came down on the key marked Enter. The lights in the room started to fade. Welcome, said Cosmos, and played a little computerized fanfare music. To the universe.
Wonderful.
I want to read chapter 5. Well, yes. I do know what happens next because I read the whole thing. But
that's great. I liked your computer voice.
I'm working
I liked
on it.
All of it. Computer voice is good.
That was George's Secret Key to the Universe, Chapter 4 by Lucy Hawking and Stephen Hawking. And we are celebrating Stephen Hawking Day today on Enlighten Radio Storytelling Hour. I'm Fanny Crawford.
And I'm Stas Ziolkowski.
And we hope you enjoyed that little bit of Stephen Hawking that we don't hear on an everyday basis, even though Stephen Hawking has become a household word. At least in
yes.
my household.
Well, and very popular with current culture
mm-hmm.
and for a number of years throughout his life was very well known. You know, he played chess on Star Trek with Data.
That's right.
And he also has appeared in the Comedy Weekly sitcom
Big Bang Theory. Yes.
And he appeared in a number of other productions on television as a guest.
He's a science rock star.
Yes, and did not, never minded that people imitated his computer-generated voice. in fact, I read that he was offered a better voice as the computer-generated speaking devices became more and more sophisticated. He was offered a chance to have a much more natural-sounding voice, and he turned it down because he said people associate that voice with him, and he was very comfortable with it.
It became him, his voice. His voice became him.
Yeah. People would not have recognized a different sound from him.
Yeah, so. That also kind of shows his understanding of his pop image, of his ability to connect with the general public and what was important, even though it might not have been his interpersonal preference, still it made a difference to his public. And he would be aware of that and honor that.
And he was welcome to speak many places. He gave talks and lectures in many places throughout the world and in that voice.
Yes.
And so that's how you know Stephen Hawking was talking.
And as radio personalities ourselves, when we came into the studio this morning, there was John was broadcasting as we came in, and there were voices that we could hear. And I couldn't do anything until I identified who those voices were, because, of course, it was a pre-recorded program, so they weren't in the room. And identifying people by their voices has become really important to me.
Yes.
Since I've been doing storytelling and on the radio, because you can often be totally captured by a voice if it's one that you recognize. Or even
some voices are special. The sound of some voices are very special.
Mm-hmm.
And the sound of some voices are different.
Beloved voices we are talking about at the moment. Where do you want to go from here on Stephen Hawking Day?
Perhaps we could discuss some of his, some things about his work or about how his work has affected
Okay. people. Well, we could start at the beginning. I did, I know partly from talking to you and partly from reading that Stephen Hawking was born in 1942 on the 300th anniversary of the death of Galileo.
Right.
Galilei. And Hawking died just a month ago on March 14th on the anniversary of the birth of Albert Einstein. Now, Hawking himself did not make a really big deal of these bookends. Of course, he didn't know what day he would die, but he did often mention that he was born on the anniversary of Galileo Galilei's death. But now that we have the other side of that equation to look at, we also have Stephen Hawking's own words saying that, well, 200,000 other babies were also born on that date in 1942. So there can only be a limited significance to that, that coincidence. But we're storytellers, and so, of course, we have a whole different take on how we might perceive or talk about those dates and that symmetry. So what do you have to say about that, Stosh?
It's just an accident.
It's just, aww.
I think it's interesting to use coincidences like that in stories, but considering that there are 365 possible dates to be born on, plus the one extra date for leap year, it's almost impossible not to meet someone who has the same birthday, at least the same date, though a different year as yourself.
Even someone who is interested in some of the same topics that you are and made an imprint on the world in the same way?
Possibly.
Okay, I'm just being devil's advocate here.
I used to do a thing when I taught in high school. Any class I had that was at least 25 students, I would keep a record of. Over the years, I had a number of things I noted, and I would say to the kids, I would make a bet. I'll bet anybody in the room that at least two of you have the same birthday. And since you're in high school as a sophomore or a junior, and this class is all one, either sophomores or juniors, even sometimes a senior class, that you're born on the exact same day and the same year.
And were you ever proven wrong?
Probably three times in many classes, many years, that there would be no one with the same birthday. But almost invariably, people would say, oh, yeah, Joni and I were born on the same day. We've talked about that before. And it's just, it's a numerical thing. You know, there are so many possibilities in any certain number of subjects in a group like that, it'll come up. You know, statistics. It's like, which number should you bet on if you're rolling dice?
And we do like statistics.
Yes.
Sometimes big data, but...
But in telling stories, it's interesting to use dates like that mm-hmm. to make, you know...
Because people always say, oh!
Right. The first oil well drilled in the United States in the state of Pennsylvania was on August 28th, 1859, which is the same as my birthday, but in a different century.
My brother's birthday.
There you go. And that's three.
Yes.
And in storytelling, we always like threes.
Okay. So, you can take me there too.
Yes. Yeah. And, well. You know... There are lots of coincidences that we can use.
Okay. So did you, I have a science question for you.
Okay.
As opposed to a math and storytelling question. Why has Stephen Hawking not won a Nobel Prize? Now, whenever anybody asks him something related to the Nobel Prize, his answer is always, well, the fundamental physics prize is actually more important. And he's actually wrote that in right. My Brief History, his little autobiography. Right. But I think you have a science explanation.
Well, the Nobel Prize is given for someone who has contributed to the betterment and welfare of mankind. And normally, it is given, it has always been given to someone's... honor someone's work in research, and where they have made discoveries that are actually reproducible. And no Nobel Prize has been given, science prize has been given to someone just for a theory. Einstein did not get the Nobel Prize for his theory of relativity. He actually got the Nobel Prize for work he did in 1905, sitting at his desk and theorizing about the photoelectric effect. And that could be tested and proven, and that's the original reason he got the Nobel Prize. Of course, there is a Nobel Prize for peace, which is an entirely different thing, and that is very subjective. It is not objective as the prize for medicine or chemistry or physics. So also there is another thing about the Nobel Prize that no person can receive a Nobel Prize posthumously. Only twice has a person who is deceased been awarded a Nobel Prize, but that was because they were awarded the prize and died before the ceremony.
Oh.
And so they knew they had won the Nobel Prize in their field, but the ceremony takes place on December 10th each year. And in both cases, the person died in an intervening time. And they were still honored with the prize because they had already been given it.
That makes sense.
Just not presented. So Stephen Hawking will never receive a Nobel Prize.
I think he was probably okay with that by the end.
I think so. I'm not sure that he, from what I've read about him and from reading his books, I don't think he cared too much about prizes, except for a few recognitions by his peers.
Mm-hmm.
And that is more important than money or a medal.
Right.
And that's how it should be. I think the comment that you read in the book about from the excerpt you read in the George Secret to the Universe,
mm-hmm,
about what the computer wanted to hear George say,
the oath, read the scientist's oath.
Scientist oath, emphasizes the purity of science research and use of science. Not to be done for material gain and not to hurt people. And I believe that Stephen Hawking was interested in finding answers about the universe, how it works and why it works and where it came from, not in any way to make money.
I swear to use my scientific knowledge for the good of humanity.
Right.
I shall not use scientific knowledge for my own personal gain or give it to those who seek to destroy,
right,
the planet.
And he's in that book, they're echoing a number of scientists over the years who have turned down the possibility of royalties from discovery of certain kind of medicines and things. They have made it public,
mm-hmm,
and just given it away rather than get a copyright on the process or something like that and benefit personally from it.
Hmm. We should make lists.
Lists of people who did that?
Yeah, of heroes.
Yeah.
Well, hero lists.
There are lots of heroes. We talked about, that's a different thing.
Okay.
Never mind.
We're trying to stick to the theme. Okay.
Yes. Hawking had lots of interesting things to say about other things in science. If you don't mind, I'll go on. It's amazing that he is regarded as so brilliant because he became ill at a very young age. By the time he was 20, he had been diagnosed with amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, which is known as Lou Gehrig's disease, and in fact was told he only had 2 years to live.
And in Britain, I understand it's called motor neuron disease.
Right. And there was something special about him and his body's reaction to the disease. It was devastating in many ways that he became he became trapped in a wheelchair. He had no ability to walk not too long after his onset of his disease. First, he could use a regular wheelchair. After a while, he couldn't even use a motorized wheelchair. He had to be guided by someone because of his body's inability to perform what we would consider as very simple tasks. The interesting thing to me personally was that he got married at the age of 21 to Jane, his wife of... would be his wife for almost 30 years, and they knew that he would probably die in 2 years, according to the doctors, but they went ahead and got married anyway. They were determined to live instead of worrying about dying, which I think is an admirable thing.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, life goes on and throws you twists and turns that bring gifts and challenges. And
right.
He certainly led both of them certainly led a full and interesting right. life.
And he received honors that are far more important than medals in the field of science. He became the Lucasian professor at Cambridge.
And sat where Isaac Newton sat. Well, that's he held the chair.
He held the chair that
Isaac Newton.
For 30 years, which is unbelievable when at the time of his appointment, it was considered a stopgap appointment, thinking that he would not live much longer. His disease had progressed a great deal. And he lived, actually. He managed to reach the retirement age of 67 for that position. And so he was there for 30 years.
And so, went on and to live to be 76.
Continued to do some work. So yeah. The amazing thing about Hawking was that he never did experiments. He did not even care to look through telescopes and look at the stars. He preferred doing the math and thinking about the repercussions or the possibilities of what the equations said.
Can we call those thought experiments?
I think some people might, but I'm not sure they would be experiments so much as walking. In my mind, it's like walking down a road and in your mind,
mm-hmm.
and using numbers and your thought process to decide what you are seeing as a result of doing the math.
Well, when you can do the level of math in your head that Hawking could do.
Yes, yes. And if you imagine, most people have a difficult time with math if they have used a pencil and paper. They automatically have to grab for a calculator. He could not hold a pencil and write on a piece of paper. And so he had to do lots of things in his mind and be able to hold those thoughts and numbers to see the results. And he did incredibly well with that because his theories are landmark theories in many things. And for someone not used to science, physics in particular, physics and mathematics, it's very difficult to comprehend some of the things that he worked on, like, for instance, black holes. There is even a special kind of radiation that comes out of black holes that is called Hawking radiation.
Yes.
and that is part of one of his most profound theories, that a black hole does not mean that something cannot escape. The original theory of black holes was that it was such a dense place in space that nothing could get out, even light. And Hawking's theory has shown that radiation can get out of the black holes.
One of the things I found so interesting reading about him is that he did change his mind on several occasions where he was the person who came up with these radical ideas, and then it would turn out that only half that idea really worked.
Right.
And sometimes he had to eat crow because there would be somebody who would not necessarily challenge him, but just have a different idea.
Right.
And he would be outraged at the beginning that they were saying these stupid things when everyone knew that that was not possible.
Right.
And he would come around to that, yes, way of thinking if he had the evidence.
That's one of his behaviors that made him such a great scientist, a brilliant theoretical physicist, is that he was able to reconcile that his answer might not be the answer, if someone else could improve on the work he was doing or on that topic.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the mark of someone who is brilliant and worth following.
Yeah.
In a sense, because there are some people in the history of science who absolutely refuse to believe what was right in front of their brain or in their mind, in their eyes. They just refuse to see.
So that collaboration as one of the qualities that makes a great scientist.
Yes.
being able right. to be part of a team and work with
yes,
others.
It's important to be willing to step back and say, well, maybe I didn't have the answer completely, which is tough for anybody to do.
Yes.
Or at least for some of us.
I'm going to do a quick station break.
Okay.
You're listening to the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour, broadcasting from Bolivar, West Virginia. And your co-hosts, as usual, Fanny Crawford, myself.
And Stacy Okowski.
And we're talking about Stephen Hawking today. Our theme is Stephen Hawking Day. And we've had a bit of a story from a book, a children's book that Lucy Hawking and Stephen Hawking wrote together. And Stash has been telling little anecdotes and tales from Stephen Hawking's life. I think you have some quotes there, Stephen Hawking's own words.
Right. One that I'm particularly fond of is about aliens.
Oh, okay.
Okay. This is a quote from Stephen Hawking. If aliens ever visit us, I think the outcome would be much as when Christopher Columbus first landed in America, which didn't turn out very well for the Native Americans. I think it would be a disaster. The extraterrestrials would probably be far in advance of us. The history of advanced races meeting with primitive people on this planet is not very happy, and they were the same species. I think we should keep our head low. I love that he said that and that he believed that, because I have always felt that way. The idea of aliens visiting the Earth is, in my opinion, preposterous. There is absolutely no evidence whatsoever. There are UFOs, which simply mean unidentified flying objects. There are lots of those. If you live next door to a kid who has a Frisbee, you're liable to see one. But they are not piloted by aliens, and there is no evidence ever of any aliens ever visiting the Earth. There are lots of theories about it, but all the theories that I've ever come across can be easily explained by human activity. Your turn.
Setting me up, are you?
I saw that look on your face.
So what I take from this quote is something a little different. I was struck immediately by him saying meetings between primitive peoples and advanced races, of course, was a button pusher for me. But then I realized that he is calling humanity in general a relatively primitive race from what we could be possibly, or from what else might be out there in the world. And you were probably right that he's not necessarily saying we're going to meet extraterrestrials in our travels. But he does say that we should be keeping our heads low. And perhaps what he means by that is that we should not be arrogant and think we have all of the answers at this stage in our
development. Very wisely said.
And of course, if we're going to pursue space travel, which he was a big proponent of,
right.
We are just as much at risk by going out and exploring other galaxies as we might be from extraterrestrials coming here. So we probably don't even need to argue the point.
No.
Just be aware that human beings do not have all the answers.
Right. And it truly is a mathematical, it's a numbers game. There is no chance with our technology that we could reach another galaxy,
mm-hmm.
no matter
ever, what ever, built, ever, 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 ever.
Not with the technology we have.
Oh, but I'm assuming that.
Okay.
Not in my lifetime.
There's unless someone. I sound like I'm about to give a lecture, but I'm not. Here's the point I would make. The only way humans have ever moved any objects is either by pushing or pulling. Now, it doesn't mean you have to push with your hands or pull with the rope or something, but no mode of transportation or movement can be done without a push or a pull in any way.
Okay, I'm not going to argue that
okay,
point
well,
with you.
Okay, well, and that's true. So in order to go to the nearest star, we would have to travel at the speed of light for 4 years. Actually, 4.4 years. So that's 186,000 miles a second for every second.
That sounds like so much fun.
Except that no one can reach that speed. And because of all kind of limitations, one is, you know, how do you push something hard enough to get it to go fast enough? The only things that you can move at the speed of light are tiny little things like electrons.
Right, right.
So,
okay.
And if someone came from another galaxy, I think they would probably notice us not much more than if we saw a single creature like a bug or spider looking down from our third story window and saw some dot moving across the sidewalk, because they would have to be so far advanced.
We're just not that interesting.
No. And so the other thing that Hawking believed in wholeheartedly is you cannot travel in time. There is no such thing as time travel. It's not possible. People like to talk about it and like to theorize about it. It just can't be done.
He did talk about parallel universes, though.
Yes, he did. But that's imagination. I mean, in the sense that, you know, there are things that are possible that we don't know whether there could be or not.
Mm-hmm.
And so any scientist will say, there are things I can't say absolutely is not possible. But there is, unless someone comes up with a new push-pull system, space travel, or time travel rather, is not possible.
Well, one of the things that's so interesting about Stephen Hawking was that he was willing to go on these imaginary excursions, these children's books that we've been talking about. There's one of the characters in George's Secret Key to the Universe becomes trapped in a black hole, and it's George's job to get him out.
Right.
So Stephen Hawking was certainly not above going on these thought journeys,
sure,
or thought experiments that are strictly imaginary.
And he wanted younger people to have the experience of science without having to read A Brief History of Time, which would cause some of us to have our head explode. It's very deep. I did hear an interview with a person by the name of Kitty Ferguson who helped him with some
Another
of his
author.
Books,
mm-hmm.
and who was on NPR, and she was she explained how frustrating it was when she had to say to him, "Stephen, you have to rewrite this paragraph. No one will understand it." and he would say, "Well, of course some people understand it. I understand it." And but she really enjoyed working with him because he did repeatedly go over much of the stuff that they were talking about and simplify it, because he knew not everyone who would read his material was a scientist or even trained in the way he was.
Well, and just his willingness to engage with people who had a completely different worldview, like Shirley MacLaine, for example, and engage with her on her beliefs about spirituality, right, and past lives and future lives, right, and on all things possible, in a perfectly respectful,
certainly points out
engaged that he, conversation. Yeah.
That he was a respectful human being, because many people would not even talk to her because of her kind of interesting
theories. I hope you're not including yourself in that. Some people.
I better take the fifth on that. I don't want to get knocked off the microphone.
Okay. Well, I guess there's another quote. Well, there's several. He just had so many interesting, right, things to say. First of all, I do think we should talk about his life, his sense of what his place was in science, and his what could be construed as a bit of arrogance, but I think is really just him saying who he was as a scientist, and that is that his goal was simple, a complete understanding of the universe, why it is as it is and why it exists at all. And for some, as a non-scientist, that's an incredible statement to me, because I do believe that none of us will ever completely understand the universe. That's not possible. It's not why we're here.
No.
It's not what human beings, the search, the seeking is, right, what human beings do. But to think that that is possible is just an astounding bit of information for me. But I do think that that's how he kept himself interested in life when he had so many challenges in his personal world.
And at some point in the past, which we can't go back to, but at some point in the past, there may have been a few people who did know everything there was to know at the time.
Because, say more about that, Stosh.
Well, because at the time, there wasn't so much...
there wasn't so much to know.
So it's going on. And one of my favorite science courses I ever took was at the University of Maryland, where a professor was able to show us that with a very large graph, the time between the idea and the actual production of the product used to be a great deal. And over a period of time, he showed over a couple thousand years how it took sometimes years between the idea and the actual completion of a project or the building of something, creating of something. But now, computer scientist people who are good at doing software and even hardware sit at a desk 8 o'clock in the morning, they get an idea, and by 8:30, they have a new piece of software. Might be very simple, but the time between the thought and the actual formation of the thing is down to mere minutes, or even seconds in some cases.
But it's still within a fairly narrow reality, as opposed to understanding everything.
True. That's true. But, you know, 5,000 years ago, a human being didn't have a whole lot to worry about as far as understanding, other than what's for dinner, and
we'll have to pursue this.
And where, okay, do I go to keep the big things outside from eating me?
Okay. I assume that you're looking at that quote because you're going to close us out with that quote. Is that your plan?
Are we ready to close out?
Just, wow, about, yeah. Just a couple minutes left.
I'd like to close out with this quote.
Okay. That looks good to me.
We are running out of space on Earth. The only place we can go to are other worlds. It is time to explore our other solar systems. Spreading out may be the only thing that saves us from ourselves. I am convinced that humans need to leave the Earth to explore other places. And I think he was talking about this in the distant, in the not so distant future, because of what we're doing to the planet. And what we're doing to the planet is going to be we are not going to damage the planet to the point where the planet's hurt. No matter what we do, even a nuclear war will not destroy Earth. What it will do is destroy the people on Earth. Earth will spend thousands and thousands and thousands of years and still be a planet, and maybe even regenerate itself. But the danger that humans have to this is to make Earth uninhabitable for us, because of all the poisons that we make and all the kind of poor choices we make in how to take care of the planet. The planet will survive. We won't, unless we find a way to get off of it. And hopefully we won't go someplace where other people are, because we may just do the same thing again. Mankind has a very, very bad history of not improving things.
I can see that we are sowing the seeds for four or five more programs.
Oh,
we're going to have a lot more to talk about. I do want to give us two little housekeeping things, because we did not talk about the Speak Story series, but tomorrow evening, Motoko will be performing at Reynolds Hall for the Speak Story series, and you can get more information at speakstoryseries.com. And then, of course, we have Stories in the Round, the April session, the second in the series. It will be Susan Gordon at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Hagerstown, and you can get more information about that by calling me, Fanny Crawford, at 301-730-1638, or emailing me at Fanitsky, F-A-N-I-T-S-K-Y, at hotmail.com. We still have season's tickets available for all nine of the 10 sessions that we have left. But it is time to sign off. So this is Fanny Crawford.
And Stasi Olkowski.
Your co-hosts for the Noontime Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour every Monday at noonenlightenradio.org, your independent community radio station in Bolivar, West Virginia. Closing out this week's show, the Epic Enlighten Storytelling Hour offers listeners a window into the world of storytelling by traditional and non-traditional storytellers, encouraging our listening community to share, preserve, and expand all of our stories. Thanks for listening. See you next week.
See you next week.
Bye.